Hello and welcome to HackerRank Radio. This is your host, Adil Bandukwala. Our guest for today, Gokul Menon, describes himself as an average nerd working in FANG or manga now. But we think he's not average. He's rather an all-star. An alumnus of the Rutgers University, he's had a glitzy career with 9+ years of development experience in the financial sector as the vice president at Bank of America, the vice president at Deutsche Bank, and later switching paths to become a senior software engineer at Meta. He's already spent 2 years at Meta, where he's part of a small team responsible for keeping Facebook Live alive and kicking. Apart from being someone who's high on technical expertise, he's an incredible photographer, a newly turned father, and now a HackerRank All-Star. Gokul, congratulations on being named a HackerRank All-Star, and welcome to HackerRank Radio.
Thanks, Adil. That was a very flattering intro.
I also feel like Gokul's genuinely a very fun guy. I like doing a lot of research on our guests, and I found something really funny that Gokul had posted somewhere. I'm not going to reveal the source, but it was a fun joke. And here's what Gokul says. Roses are red, violets are blue. Expected an opening bracket on line 132. So for those of you who know programming or enjoy Python a little bit, I hope that struck a chord. But there you go, Gokul. You enjoy these jokes, and I hope you're still keeping this fun part of you alive.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like these programming jokes. I share these memes on Facebook that I find funny, you know.
Awesome. So with that, I'll jump straight into the podcast, Gokul. You know, after working for like 9 years in the financial sector, developing products like trading platforms, how did you feel about moving sectors from finance to social media? I'm very curious, what did you have to learn from scratch at Meta?
Sure. Taking a step back, like I did my master's in CS. I was always in tech, but then I started my journey in a professional career with finance. So when I interned with Bank of America, I was building a loan trading system. And then I joined them full time. I worked there for 7 years, slowly growing up the ranks to VP and team lead. And we were basically building tools for traders and salespeople. But I was still building technology. I was still writing software. But one of the things I saw was being on the business side would get me more pay. And being the one writing the derivatives or the financial modeling or even the risk systems is more lucrative. So I wanted to become a strategist. So I switched to Deutsche Bank as a strat. And I was still writing code, but I was going towards more towards the financial math and the quant side of things. And I realized then that I wasn't enjoying spreadsheets and math and math white papers and modeling options as much as I enjoyed writing technology for people, as much as I enjoy writing a backend, a full stack app end-to-end for a system. So I enjoyed writing code and building software more than I enjoyed writing financial modeling. So I knew that I had to leave, you know. So I started, and this time I said, you know what, instead of going to another financial firm, I'm going to go for the place where tech is supreme and where engineering is first. Because I always felt like in financial sector, engineering is considered second or third. It's never a first culture. So that's why I decided to go to tech company. So I applied to several and then, you know, pick up the draw, I landed at Meta. In terms of what I needed to study from scratch, being a full stack engineer for 9 years, I didn't really have to study anything from scratch because like you have 9 years of like building software and writing and, you know, dealing with backend. One thing I did have to study from scratch, but maybe is PHP hack, which is used widely at Facebook. I had to like quickly pick up that, but luckily it's very similar to language like Python. So I was able to ramp up. Pretty much Facebook has this culture of bootcamp. But every single new engineer goes through an 8-week process of ramping up, getting to know the tooling, the IDE, the repos, the monorepos, all the data tooling. So by the time you're through that process, you have like a fast ramp to learning a lot of the stuff that Facebook uses. So I think every Facebook Meta engineer goes through that process. So I was lucky to like go through that process to quickly learn. So I didn't feel like I had a big gap compared to the other people who are coming in from tech. I hope that answers that question.
Yes, it does. Let's talk a little more about Meta, right? What does your work at Meta involve today? And what are a few things that you are currently working on? We'd love some depth here.
Sure. So like I said, at the bootcamp, you have this process at Meta where you get to choose a team after sitting with several teams, right? So there's a team matching process internally. And the way it is set up is it's not a second interview. It's like you've cleared the bar, made an, like, you've decided your level, and now you have to choose a team that has an open headcount for that level. And then you get to be the first one, first call. You, like, team doesn't get to choose you. So that empowers you to, like, pick the team that you're passionate about, pick the product within Facebook that you're passionate about that you will work, and then you seal your fate that way. So I had to choose between several teams, and I sat with Instagram, I sat with Facebook ads team, I sat with another infra backend team, I sat Facebook Live, a video team. And then, yeah, it hashed out to like a couple of teams, and then eventually I landed at Facebook Live, where I chose live video. One of the things that attracted me to live video in general was the fact that it was one of the biggest user-facing teams I interviewed with. Most of the teams were usually internal tooling, backend, or ads. But the fact that I could work on a product that my mom would use, like, was something that drove me to live video. It was an end-user product. So I literally went from building software for 20 people or 200 people to like 2 billion people. So that was very, very motivating. I'm going to be a product engineer on the back end, but my product is going to be Facebook Live video as a viewer. So that was definitely a draw. So that's what I chose. I'm still in the same team. So it's almost 2 years now, and I've been in this team. We've had a few reorgs, but essentially what our team does is we drive the viewer side work on Facebook Live on all platforms. So that means on desktop, Android, iOS. When you watch a live video, the surface of the app or the part of the app that serves and the backend that serves this infra is something that our team uses. We are still a product team, so we don't really deal with the infra layers like ingest, encoding, all the good stuff on the backend. We are primarily a user-facing product team. We build the UI for the player, the playback. We support live notifications, live comments. We build new tooling on the viewer side for enhancing this experience. And sometimes we also collaborate with the live broadcasting experience team to like work together. Like, for example, we are working on a project that was recently featured in TechCrunch to bring more discovery and new features tools to live creators. The focus lately from Meta has been to focus on this creator economy. Meta believes that the next, you know, big thing is going to be individual creators that will rise up. So focus on upcoming and rising creators and give them a good platform. And Facebook has the reach to like allow these creators to actually monetize and make a living. So one of the parts of this is live video, where creators are very authentic. Live is like an authentic moment and they have real-time engagement. So keeping that latency down to a single digit second means that fans can engage live, creators can talk to their audience live, and it's not just a video they prepare, set up and post and get reactions, but this is like happening live. So there's a separate energy for live that we want to focus on and build that audience. So that's what my team does, building software, building experiences and features for viewers. But occasionally, we, like in the case of the featured discovery tools that we're making, like for example, one of the tools we're making is allowing the live creator to share a link and then having that link show up to the viewers in a safe manner so that it's not just a comment with a link, but actually a button. Safe way to say, hey, we have vetted this link. This is not spam. This is not, you know, scam or any NSFW. This is safe. And that drives affiliate links and discount codes that creators can do. So that's one of the features that we recently launched and we're working to like build the next version of. There are some other exciting things that are upcoming, but they're not yet public. So unfortunately, I cannot share them. But definitely watch out for Facebook Live video space. We are competing with TikTok and YouTube. And we are one of the leaders in live video watch time overall globally. So it's one of the few spaces in entertainment that Facebook actually competes and is a leader.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we love Facebook Live, Vukul, because we have a program where we run live streams every month. And the current model is we do that once a month with typically CTOs and VP engineerings worldwide. And we see some crazy traction on Facebook. So we totally get it. And we love Facebook Live. Keep the good stuff going. But I'd love to get a little deeper on Facebook Live. You know, we're privy to aspects of the front end, like the stream and then the comments and then the likes, the layout and the live engagement and the spontaneity and all of that. Can you give us a quick peek through what happens on the back end when a person goes live?
Sure. I can give a bird's eye view. This is a question that can eat up the entire podcast and I'll still not be done because a project that started for just celebrities had to be scaled to everyone on the planet. And if you look at just the scope of the feature set that we are providing, we're basically saying 2 billion people can all go live at the same time, right? I mean, there's no restriction in the app that says you're not allowed to go live. There's no eligibility for going live. So everyone on Facebook can literally go create a post, select live video, allow permission for camera, and then hit the go live. And, you know, the infra will probably will all crash, but I mean, there's no restriction, right? That's the scale of the feature. So taking a step back again, what is it like from end to end, like a life cycle, right? So let's talk life cycle. I'll divide the answer in two parts, right? I'll start with the broadcaster's experience of what's going on, and then I'll start with the viewers because they are slightly different experiences. So the broadcaster first has to log in all that good stuff and then finally decides to go live. So he clicks the, you know, go live button. At this point, what's happening is before the go live button is clicked, we've already prepared a bunch of metadata in the backend to be ready for the live because at any point the stream will start. So even before you hit live, you're already accepting raw footage, ingesting it, encoding it, and making it available. Even though it's not ready to go for public, it's still ready for the broadcaster to consume. So they can do a mic check, they can do like makeup check and all that. So we actually start the live before you hit go live, but we don't publish it to the viewers. We return it back to the broadcaster so they can see their own live, right? Once they go live, we start the actual process of saving these chunks of media that the camera is sending to our servers. And we do this in two ways. We use RMTP protocol to send it back in small pieces over TCP/IP back. And we use a mix of protocols to like do smart segmentation. And we have a manifest service to like take this transcoded segmented copies back to the, you know, viewer side and cache it on our Edge CDN server so that, you know, it's in the same region two viewers are consuming it, they'll use the cache. This is live, this is happening in stream, and you know, we keep ingesting. So there's an entire team that's focused on ingest, and there's a team that's focused on encoding. We make decisions like how much encoding and how much compression. We have like a triangle trade-off between stalls, quality, and network. So we need to like optimize. For example, if Justin Bieber is going live, we need to like make sure that we'll use more computer encode and compress because we know that there'll be 12 million followers who want to probably see it, and some of their phones are old and the client won't be able to do all the encoding, right? But if it's someone like not Justin Bieber, but just with 300 followers going live, we probably won't do that. We do a dynamic encoding structure where we decide where to spend compute, and we have capacity planning and growth to like revisit this as we grow and as more people start using live. So that's sort of like a bird's eye view of what happened on the broadcaster side. In terms of viewer, a viewer's first entry point will probably be a notification. A push notification is sent to all followers that are subscribing to live. So when our broadcaster goes live, we batch out these push notifications, fan them out, and send them to all devices. And once the viewer decides to engage and open the player, the viewer then will hit the dash or HLS endpoint, which is basically the point at the edge of Facebook's infrastructure that serves this out to all our viewers across the world. The cache from the server side that's feeding in these segments, the manifest that tells the player that, hey, the live is ready, and this is the segments that you have to play. And then, of course, you know, TCP/IP, the packets are jumbled, so the client has to reorder. And then we sync on audio. So audio and video are separately sent in chunks. And then we use the audio stream to sync the audio and video. And we also pass metadata, like, in the audio for the player, so to do other things. For example, in gaming, we have gaming actions, or games are actually being streamed from a gamer's, you know, machine, scores or kills or something. Metadata for a gaming action can be passed down to the live streaming along with the audio metadata for the live gaming video player to show additional data along with the live data. We also allow like graphics, like you can put like a ticker or something in your live if you're going live via an API. So again, those things are passed down via the audio metadata and we show them to the viewer. So that's like a very big overview. We use Everstore for the final copy and saving the media. We save the media in multiple formats. We also do on the client side a lot of instrumentation to make stalls less. Stalls are basically when your network is slow or your encoding is not catching up, but then the stream is coming through a network that has got less bandwidth. So you're not able to, you know, see the video. You see buffering. And then what we do is we reduce the quality of the image that we're sending over so that the size of the compressed packets are less and that squeezes in and you're able to be current and instead of being behind over time due to the stalls. So that's like the overall answer of what is going on behind. There's of course a lot more that I've skipped purposefully. Like for example, comments, right? Real-time comments are our biggest challenge because it's not just one broadcaster going live and doing something real-time that we need to publish to everyone. It's everyone watching, commenting in real-time. And then, you know, we have problems like race condition. We have problems like how do we rank these comments? Like, so quick example of that, client A puts a comment through a composer, client A's comments gets created on the server accepts the comment. Now, the client A will immediately see the comment stick, but that's not what happens on the server. We filter and rank it. The person is shadow banned and they wouldn't know that the comment is not sticky. Then we get the comment published on the actual stream, but then now we have to rank and then publish on the stream. And then we finally also do a publish throttling so people can spam the comment by like, you know, trying to take over the stream by continuously sending a lot of comments. And then, of course, on the client B, who's just viewing the stream, they need to like listen to this publish and render it as a stream, not to mention like streaming reactions and likes and all that good stuff. So that is a separate layer that's completely decoupled from the actual broadcast. And we keep it to sync with GraphQL subscriptions. So that's comments. And then there's more, but yeah, like this covers, I think, good backend.
That is fascinating. I mean, come to think of it, there's so much depth to what all you all do, because as consumers, what we see is just, hey, this is a live video. Let's go engage with it. You know, I really want to be part of it. I want to be part of this conversation. Let me go type a comment. Let me see if there are reactions. Let me try and see who's part of this stream. But you don't realize there's so much of ranking and structuring and code and segmentation and whatnot, just to bring this whole thing to life. So it's one of those things that magical, but seldom one will realize how much hard work actually goes into it. So kudos to you and team at Meta for building such an amazing product. If I can ask a follow-up question there, what are a few metrics and KPIs that you believe are very useful to you to judge the performance of people who are working on your team? Like, for example, there must be so many backend engineers, right, who are working on your team. How do you judge their performance? Because you're working on an incredible complex product. There's so much happening. So what do you focus on?
Okay. So a lot of the problems we face are pretty much solved across the company, right? We have an infrastructure that is designed to do exactly this kind of stuff, right? So, I mean, of course, live video is a slightly more complicated challenge, but I would say that, you know, I am a product backend engineer, right? So my growing pains or my complexity that I have to deal with is probably an order of magnitude less than the infra guys or the ingest guys or the encoding guys, because they're actually like much lower level in the stack and closer to the action. But we are consumers of that infra. So if a backend engineer joins my team, they don't have to deal with like a lot of the stuff that I just mentioned, because that's already done, right? It's common. So they'll have to deal with more of the backend of the business logic. Like, for example, they might have to deal with, okay, what do we show in the full screen player that will make live more engaging? So those are the kind of engineering that they will be looking at. So to answer that first question of what are the useful metrics or KPIs to judge a backend engineer, I don't think it's just the lines of code. I think that just shows productivity in a very broad stroke. At Meta, we look at a very holistic view of performance. So performance for us are on four axes: direction, people, impact, and excellence, right? We are expected to be performing on all these four axes. So if you see, writing code is just one of them. So you can argue that if you spend 25% of your time writing code, you can still be a successful backend engineer here, because it's easy to write code. It's very hard to write what is only needed. It's very easy to feature creep, right? It's very easy to be enthusiastic and just go write a bunch of code, but it's very hard to actually write only what's needed or understand. So we are cognizant of that, hey, I just don't want to write stuff. I want to understand stuff and write only what's necessary. So sometimes writing too much code is also a problem, because like we'll have young engineers who are trying to show off that they can, you know, make it. But then we end up writing a lot of chunk code or legacy code that never gets used, or experiments that never get cleaned up. So we do a lot of A/B testing before we release anything to viewers. So that ends up having extra cycles. So I think a successful backend engineer should know how to read data, should know how to make reasonable hypotheses and run experiments to validate them, and should be able to write and understand a code on a large code base like Meta, and be a good human being and a good engineer to work with. Like, we have this behavioral part of our interview process that tries to get people who are enthusiastic and happy and easy to work with, instead of like, you know, someone who's difficult to work with. So that would be like the overall metrics or axis that you can judge performance of a backend engineer. In terms of what metrics backend engineers care about, that's an open question, right? Depends on where in the stack you are. If you're in the playback team, you care about stalls. We call it TTRC. It's time to render content, right? If I open any UI, any live video, and there's a spinner wheel that takes 30 seconds to start the live, that's TTRC of 30 seconds. That's crazy, right? We will lose all our viewers if that's the state of life. So there is certain parts of the metrics we care about are very specific to user experience. Certain parts of the stack, we care about metrics that are overall overarching goal. Are we reaching our overarching goal, right? We have changed our goals from being exclusively watch time focused, based on research and feedback over the years, that we've already got the attention of users. So we don't need to be growth hacky anymore. We need to now provide that extra quality of experience and differentiate ourselves from our competitors, right? So the metrics question is a bit of a challenge. Some of the metrics are not public, but I would say in general, my personal opinion is that backend engineers should be putting in a lot of logging to give insight on your performance, write the right kind of tests. You know, testing is super important at scale. If your coverage is good and if your testing methodology is good, you can catch a lot of these issues early. So in terms of metrics, the KPIs, personally, I think we should go for quality metrics more than product metrics. If the product quality is very high, like I think I would use Instagram as an example. I think the Instagram design quality and product quality is very high. So it makes us an attractive product. But I think Instagram cares deeply about quality metrics, right? So I think that's my personal take as well. We should be focusing more on quality metrics and user-facing metrics and building features that users will love. Even users across the world where network is a challenge, where the client devices are old. So I think I would make that bar lower for more client devices to use live. So, you know, for example, FB Lite doesn't have streaming live reactions. And when we tried to add it, we ran into issues. So those are some of the challenges our engineers are trying to solve. And I think that's meaningful, right? So the metrics we care about there would be like, hey, how can we provide live on older devices with really bad 2G network, right? Can we even do it? We consider like going audio only, for instance, if we detect a low instance stream, but still give them closed captions, you know, things like that. So yeah, that's where the metrics question, I would say personally, like quality metrics.
Amazing insights. Let's deep dive into one of the things that you spoke about. One of the things that you spoke about when talking about performance of a backend engineer, you said the ability to read data and make informed decisions based on these data cohorts are super important. So I was doing some research, and within 2 years of its launch up to 2018, Facebook had wrapped up about 3.5 billion live streams, which is an insane number. And I'm sure that number has even more than quadrupled since then. Naturally, the data that you deal with has obviously increased multifold too. Therefore, according to you, now, what are a few good practices or best practices that should be followed when dealing with huge amounts of data?
So just to start off, I want to mention that at Meta, we have tools, we have database abstractions, and we have infrastructure. So just to name a few, we have something called ODS, we have Scuba and Hive. You can think of them like three different types of data. ODS is a data that is real time, usually counters, metrics like a CPU, RAM, memory, all the basic stuff about a process that you need real time. For example, if we see that people are not able to log in, right? The login counter is going down from 1 billion to like 300 million or something. We see that drop. That's real-time data that's coming in from these ODS counters all over the world when apps are making that counter not go up, right? So that's data that we rely on for alarms and like quick debugging, right? Real-time data. That's super important. But then we don't keep that around for longer. So that you can say that ODS data lives for a very short time, 24 hours, maybe a week at max, because that's too much data. I don't need the CPU cycle average time for this server for the whole year. Like, what am I going to do with that? So that's throwaway data. That's not user data. That's just counters and, you know. Then we have Scuba. Scuba is our own internal tooling to visualize and be like, look at data, logging data, look at business data, look at all kinds of data, but on a longer time frame. So we have like Scribe to like bring in and ingest this. And Scuba is literally an in-memory data store. It's like 100 petabyte or something. Like, don't quote me on that. I have no idea what the actual sizes, but it's some ridiculous big data. Every query is highly parallelized, and you can get to like a massive amounts of data stored on memory within under 1 second. The goal was under 1 second, get us random data from random tables, right? As long as the same namespace. So these are all relational data. You can do query joins and all that good stuff. But then because they're all highly parallelizable, MapReduce on the fly, you can get these things really, because they're also in memory, you're never hitting the disk. It's super fast. Now, of course, having Scuba makes like life easier for a developer at Meta, but not everyone has Scuba. Not everyone has this rich tooling. So my answer will be like slightly biased towards Meta. But what are best practices at Meta to not blow up our infra? Even though we have crazy infra and crazy capacity, we still need to do good practice. But then for companies outside who don't have Scuba, their constraints might be higher, right? They won't even have an in-memory data store to use. They might have to rely on disk, in which case their optimization will go on to like other things like having executable queries that are running fast or, you know, optimizing queries. And then we have finally Hive, which is like a catch-all data that Scuba, when it goes out of retention after 30 days or so, it goes into Hive. And Hive has a slightly longer, 90 days or more in some cases, but then Hive also has retention. So ultimately, we throw away most of the data we ingest because it's too much, right? Most of the data is logging, funnel data, users clicking here and there, and you know, getting us impression data, click-through rates on different buttons, all that kind of product data. It's not really relevant 5 years from now. So the first best practice is figure out your retention period. How much time you really need that data? Sometimes you overestimate. We don't need this data for more than 30 days. If there's no issue, everything's going well, we can throw it away. We can condense it into like a single summary and throw it away. So a pruning logic and a retention scheme and a proper governance model on data is like priority zero. Like if you don't have that, it's a chaotic mess and you will hit your capacity sooner than you know. Engineers will love to get log more stuff. Engineers will love to like have more tables and engineers love to have more analysis. So at some point, data scientists have come in and scoped this out. So we have capacity planning, capacity growth teams that literally like the entire job is to just make sure that one day it doesn't happen that we are hitting 100% capacity and no hard drives to fill, right? So it's a full-time job of several teams to like make sure that doesn't happen, right? Start planning. So first answer is governance, planning, retention period, pruning. That saves you a bunch of capacity over time. Second thing is privacy anonymization, right? Privacy is a big deal at Meta. As you know, we take this very seriously. We have a privacy wave that goes and touches every single product. We have inbuilt tools that warn engineers that they're touching user data and they need to go through a review. And we have reviews internally that set up before launching any product. We do exhaustive and rigorous reviews, right? This helps us in logging as well and how to deal with data. Because if you have, as a policy, decided that this is user data, I won't keep it for more than 30 days, then automatically a large chunk of your data is saved, right? You don't have to keep this. So that's like a good practice to have. Is this privacy? Is this user sensitive? Then try not to keep it. The longer you keep user data, the more chances someone can hack into you and get it or something else can leak. So privacy leaks, theft, that's one thing. So a way to mitigate that is anonymization. Right, we have tools at Facebook that anonymize user ID. So if an engineer wants to look at something and he can look at an anonymized table, just not really look at individual user accessible data like user IDs, Instagram ID or Facebook ID, but then actually look at some anonymized ID, but then able to tell the same user in two different systems, for example. That's another thing. Yeah, rigorous capacity, growth planning I mentioned, privacy, sampling. I think this is key. I think everybody does this. But sampling rates and dynamic sampling also helps, right? For example, you don't want to sample employees. If employees are writing code and adding logging and it goes to a table, you don't want to say, oh, 1,000 events like this, one of them I'll take, I'll sample them, right? Because then when you're debugging, employees will be like, hey, I can't see the log, logging's broken. So obviously employees can't be sampled. But then you can sample external hits. So at a place like Facebook, like you have 2 billion hits on something, you don't need all 2 billion rows in the database, right? That's crazy. Like if 10% of all users are seeing a feature, then 1,000 to 1 sampling in a billion row is good enough. Statistically, there's no difference in a billion rows and a million rows when you're looking at 10% problems, right? If it's a very unique problem affecting only 0.0001%, yeah, sure, you might miss some samples. But that's the risk we are willing to take, right? It's unlikely we'll have an edge case that will impact such a tiny portion of our user base that we'll never worry about it. So we will sample aggressively, right? Depending on how noisy and how frequently we are. And we also do smart things like batching. So for example, on Android and iOS, when you're in the main thread and the UI experience, you possibly cannot steal CPU cycles to even write logging. At our scale, we write so much logs that the user experience will suffer if we are stealing UI threads to log. But at the same time, we want to do live logging. You want to make sure that the live comments are, you know, not broken. So there's a balance to strike. So what we do is we still steal some CPU cycles, but we batch it. Every time a user does an action, we don't literally go to the server and say, yeah, he did this. We're going to like, maybe a minute later, we'll say, hey, he did this. So we're like smart batching on our client code that handles this kind of sampling. We also have server-side sampling. So if the client code engineers didn't do a good job, we have server engineers that will say, hey, I'll take only like 1,000 of them. I'm going to discard 99 of these writes because my sampling ratio is 1,000 to 1. So that's an incredible tool to like manage the stuff and make this easy to deal with. But having said that, like my experience is like, it's like magic. I have queried on tables that span billions of rows in seconds. And the only reason that's even possible is because 40,000 machines momentarily took my job, ran that part of the SQL script, and then 30,000 other machines stitched that answer, and some 10,000 other machines condensed it back to a result. And that third machine was job was to tell me it's done, tells me it's done, right? So it's like parallelization at scale and distributed computing at its best that allows me to dig into this data and do these kind of complicated queries very quickly on Scuba. And then visualize them quickly and then interpret them, right? So yeah, I'm lucky to be at a place like this, which has this kind of infra already in place for product engineers to move fast. But I would imagine it will be incredibly challenging to set this up ground up, right, in a new company. So hopefully other companies are doing some of the things I mentioned. And then if they're not, they should be.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that perspective. I think it gives us good visibility into what the tech and processes are like at Meta that give people the exponential ability to just do path breaking stuff, because there's so much you can do on your own. But then if you have infra that can give you that, in gaming terminology, nitro boost to just go ahead and leapfrog to the next level of growth, I think that's what Meta is doing. And that's so cool to hear.
I think one thing that helps us is, at least for the data we are speaking about, like usability data or logging data from engineering, we don't need asset guarantees for this data, right? This is not banking data that has to have like very strict asset guarantees and no consistency. We can tolerate some misses because the data insertion rate and the quantity of data is so much that if I miss 1% of all logging across Facebook, it's still useful because there's so much data, right? 99% is still more than enough to get you going. So we don't have perfect logging. Like, we do have gaps and we do have issues. But because we're not like a bank and we don't deal with, like, if a user clicks on a like and, you know, we don't register a logging for that like, but the like still makes it, that's what counts. So logging is secondary in that sense. And we don't need asset guarantees for developer, like, consuming logging, right? If the developer is making decision on a product on A/B testing and writing logging, we don't need asset guarantees on that. So we make some liberty when we're designing this. And that's why they're fast, right? I'm sure a JP Morgan or a Bank of America wouldn't be able to like do some of this stuff because they need asset guarantees on some of their data. So that gives us some, you know, advantage.
What about someone who wants to join Meta as a backend developer? What are the languages, frameworks, tools they should learn to fit right in?
They should reach out to me on LinkedIn and I'll tell them. I have to be a little specific here. So when you say working at Meta, backend engineer, like, do you know if they're experienced engineer in the industry or are they new grad? Because we have multiple programs at Meta. Like, for example, we have a program that's called rotational engineering. And that is a program for folks that don't have a CS degree, but are actually already in the industry writing code. They are the ones who have a tougher time moving jobs because they don't have a degree in computer science or IT or whatever. But they've done something like economics or something else, but they've pivoted to writing JavaScript and now are like front-end developers or whatever. They are back-end developers. Meta actually is interested in hiring these people as well. We have a separate track for them, and that's called a rotational engineering. And the idea is you join in similar to a new grad with a degree, like on equal footing, but we'll put you like on training wheels and we'll let you be lower calibrate, like lower expectations from you, so that we know that you don't have a, you know, academic background to like some of the CS stuff we have to deal with. So we'll try to like give you a shot at a lower level. You might have 3 or 4 years of experience in the industry, but you'll join in on par with a new CS grad and then you both will be judged equally, right? So Meta gives that opportunity for even people who don't have CS degrees. So I would say the bar is actually, like, contrary to public opinion, the bar is actually low in terms of, are you eligible to apply or will you fit in? Like, of course, we are hiring like crazy, like 10,000 developers a year for the next 5 years. We have 3,000 open positions. So I'll take this opportunity to like give a shout out to hiring at Meta and say that they've been doing an exceptional job. It's really hard to hire so many engineers. It's not like they're all sitting without a job. Like, most engineers are employed. It's very hard to get them out of their comfort zone or their current employee and bring them to Meta. So we are hiring. There are lots of opportunities for new grads, for people without CS degrees and, you know, seasoned engineers. The path and the requirements for each will be slightly different. But I think overall, if you're writing code and you're like, can write code in some language and you've written code in some language for a while, I think you'll be fine. The philosophy at Meta is more about our culture shift than about programming. We believe that good engineers will learn any language we throw at them. There's no, like, that's our belief. We don't really like have a sacred cow. We don't have like a sacred language that we think that is superior to others. We use all the languages available. We use the best tool for the job. And if the language doesn't fit a company's product or fit the company's culture, we change the language, right? An example being Hack. We realized early on that PHP is not, you know, it's going to be a mess if everyone's writing untyped. At the same time, the cost of moving to C++ or Python or something else, not Python, sorry, anything that's typed, or Java, for example, would be so expensive that it'll bring the company down. So we realized, wait a minute, we can just fix this and add a type setting on top. So it's what started as just a type checking system on top of PHP evolved into its own language, right? It's indistinguishable from PHP. If you're looking at Hack code, you'll just read it as PHP with some odd syntax that Hack has. But for the most part, it's PHP with a type checker on top, which is incredibly useful, right? I come from an untyped dynamic typing world and I love Python. I love Python, right? But you know, the lack of type checking actually at scale can be crazy. Like, you really need to know what you're doing, or you can really write really crazy runtime bugs. So type checking is one of the best lines of defense we have for, you know, checking something before it even goes to the server, right? In the binary rather. So we don't believe in like a language. I don't think you need to learn PHP to join. Like, I didn't know PHP and I was interviewed and they looked at a resume. I like didn't have PHP and it's all good, right? Only JavaScript might be a weaker resume than JavaScript, C++, Java or whatever. So having a core language or a high level language, you know, like Java, C++, Python, Rust, you know, the top seven or whatever, those Haskell. If you know any of those and you've worked on those, I think that's, you probably don't need to worry. If you've never worked on anything and you've only done JavaScript front end, and you want to be a backend meta engineer, then you're going to have a tougher hill to climb, right? So even then, I think we bifurcate our roles. We have SWE, what we call SWE. We have SWE UR, that is University Recruit. We have SWE Rotational Eng. And then we have in SWE, we have product and infra. So there's like a lot of like different roles that you can go for. And if you want to go for a front end, you can go for a product and then be a product generalist or a web developer. And you'll be focusing on React and the front end good stuff, right? And if you're a back end guy with C++, then you can be an infra or like even product back end. So I would say have one core programming skill on your, like in your quiver, perseverance and believing in yourself. It's like, I thought that I was not good enough for Meta. Personally, I thought that there were gods. There's imposter syndrome that sets in when you join initially. That's discussed internally and we have coaching to avoid it. So it's like, hey, am I good enough? These are these awesome people here. Like, will I fit in? Will I do well? So there's always that. So I think believing in yourself and, you know, that also helps. And like that's a good advice I would give to anyone who's like looking to be in the interview loop or interviewing with us. Like, believe in yourself, persevere, and you know, the bootcamp process will take care of any ramp up you need, right?
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that, Google. You kept it very, very real, because the last bit of what you shared, that can be super helpful, because a lot of times people will say, oh my God, this is Meta. What if I'm just not good enough? Like you exactly said, right? And there's so much baggage that one has to deal with. And then when you're interviewing, all of that suddenly seeps in. So what you gave us, I think, is very, very real. Thank you for keeping it very, very real. So with that, let's shift gears and switch into this fun segment we've designed, where we request you to give us your quick 10 to 15 second opinions on a few questions that we have, whether you relate to this backend stereotype or not. Okay, so we're going to ask you four questions and let's see if you relate to it and your quick comments for 10 to 15 seconds each. The first one, backend developers are more antisocial than frontend developers.
Not true.
reason, quick, I mean, 10 second reason.
I don't know where that came from. I like it's like saying apples are blue. Like, no, they're not.
Sounds good. You feel that backend work is way more difficult than frontend work?
Not true again. I would encourage someone to look at the frontend code for live streaming API, like live streaming reactions, for example. Like, that's sophisticated. That it's not simple, not trivial. Yeah, no. Like, you can say, argue that most cases, sure, but not true.
Okay. Backend people are very underappreciated.
This is something I think maybe true tech or outside of Meta, but not true at Meta.
Okay.
It might be even the opposite.
That's an interesting one. Do backend devs drink more coffee and frontend devs drink more Red Bull? Is a thing like that? Is that even true?
The first time I'm hearing it, not true. But hey, I drink coffee, so I don't know.
All right. So now let me ask you another question, right? How and when did you first learn about HackerRank? And what's your experience been like?
I learned about HackerRank in what, 2013 or 14, when I was preparing for a Google full loop. I think that was, I was going for a junior role, a level four. This was, yeah, it's in 2014. And that's when I like was looking at LeetCode and HackerRank. I remember HackerRank before LeetCode, actually. I actually started with HackerRank first, more problems than I like community. I think HackerRank was slightly more structured. Like, and then I think I later went to LeetCode after the Google loop around 15 or 16. And then LeetCode, I think, had a bigger community and a bigger brand. But I felt like it was not very structured and there were way too many problems thrown at you. HackerRank felt like a more structured and I could like, you know, see some progress. So that's what I could contrast between the two. But yeah, super helpful to like get the variety of problems and, you know, practice it, because you don't get to do these kind of things at a regular job. So I would spend an hour or two every day just like solve. And I sort of gamified it in my head. I'd be like, hey, I didn't get it last week. So I got to get this time. I need to get two out of three that I pick. So do any, mini, mini, more, and pick two problems. And I hope I get like problems that I solve. And the way I would do it was I would like try to solve my own. If I don't get it, I would look at the community answers, look at the best one. And then again, go back without like try to solve it again now that I know the path. And then I think I bookmarked that one. And then I would go back to it a week or two later, see if I remember how to solve it again. So it's sort of like for the tough problems, I would like have a lot of trouble. But then the community answers and the comments and that, like sometimes the questions are wrong and the community is helpful to point out. So like, oh, there's missing a test case is broken or something. So I think it's more than just the problem solving. It's also the community that's helpful. That's useful. That kept me at Hack Rank.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And with that, I think it's a wrap, Gokul. Thank you for joining us all the way from New York for this podcast. I learned a lot, got to know a lot about backend developers, a lot about what you're building at Meta, particularly the whole Live product in the form of Facebook Live. And I'm super excited to go work on this and get this out in the open so a lot more people can learn from your expertise and your experience. With that, congratulations again for being recognized as a HackerRank All-Star.
Thank you, Adil. It was nice talking to you.